Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. My name is Michael Walker, and I am here with my good friend, Mark. How are you today, Mark?
I'm well, Walker. How are you?
Fantastic. This is, like I said, a show about board games. We're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. We're going to talk about the games we played this week. We're going to talk about some news and why it completely doesn't matter. Then we're going to go to our feature topic, which we've covered before, but now we've aged and we have life experience.
It's funny. I feel like I've aged a few years every time you utter a sentence.
Yikes. And we're going to talk about teaching rules.
Rules explanations is I have a soapbox moment or two coming up, Walker. Oh. And indeed, this is hard-won wisdom. I want to try to inspire people to encourage a cultural change in our little hobby. But that is for later. For now, we have the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the Eurus. Walker, what did we review last year?
We reviewed exactly 1 year ago Sacra Arms, which is like a two-player card battling game. The thing that sets it apart is that you pick two fighters that you enjoy, and you shuffle their decks together. And
you select from their abilities. Yes, you get to build a deck at the outset. And one of the things that I appreciate is that if you're playing like a monkey, then there are lovely moments of discovery. And even by the second or third shuffle through, you have a good sense of what your opponent can do and a better sense of what you can do. And it also leads to more competitive play if you're so inclined. This is the Level 99 Games version. AEG put out a somewhat abbreviated version a few years before that. And the Japanese version is still going strong. They're constantly releasing new characters. I have not had any updates to my Japanese version. I kind of obsoleted it because I'm tired of dealing with paste-ups. And I've been just using the Level 99 version. There's been no indication from Level 99 that they intend to release any future content. They haven't said that they won't, but there's just been radio silence for the past couple of years because the intent was stated at the time of their publication that they were going to keep this version up to date. They were going to publish new characters and balance changes for existing characters. So far, no word on that. I've played Sacra Arms a bunch of times since we reviewed it. I've introduced it to a number of people. It's won a fair number of new friends. I'm a massive fan. It's probably my favorite two-player card battler after Blue Moon. Not counting some of the incredibly short two-player card games, like your Sale in the cooperative vein, or Air, Land, and Sea in the competitive vein. But for something slightly more in-depth, I really like Sacra Arms. It's in Battlecon. I can't tell which one I prefer. They both have their strengths.
Yeah, well, just the production value and the art in Sacra Arms is enough to get me to come back. It is a fantastic game.
Very highly recommended. And I do appreciate the fact that in the Level 99 Games version, you can get a box with eight fighters for a relatively low cost of entry, which is very nice. So if you're at all curious, I would recommend you go pick up the Urina box. That is sort of the easiest set of characters to master. Most straightforward, at least. Not necessarily the best or strongest, but as Yoda would say, the quicker, most direct path. So that's Sacra Arms by Backafire, published by Level 99 Games.
And that is a game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago. Now, on to the games we played last week. What did you play, Mark?
We played La Granja Deluxe Master Set. So La Granja was originally published a few years before that, and then Board and Dice kickstarted a reprint with new components and new modules. So some of these modules had already been published in the La Granja expansion. And then there were some new ones and a whole bunch of new cards. This is one of the reasons why, if you go to check the entry on BoardGameGeek, there is a list of designers a mile long, and that's because everybody who contributed a card got a design credit on the BoardGameGeek listing. But in point of fact, it was actually designed this edition by Michael Keller and Andreas Odendahl, so all the other people are mostly just guest spots. So La Granja reminds me an awful lot of Cryo. Now, Cryo was published after La Granja, so I should make clear that I'm not saying that one is derivative of the other when it's the other way around. But one of the key appeals in La Granja isn't so much the actions you're doing, but it's more the multi-use cards. Any card can be used in one of four ways. It can be an order you need to fulfill, a special ability, a field to generate resources, or it's called a farm extension. It's just a miscellaneous sort of grab bag of additional bonuses from hand size to pig pens and things like that. I very much enjoyed that, and it's an economic model that rewards a certain degree of setting up the ability to fulfill orders in as quickly as possible. That's one of the key ways to get points. You need to generate the resources, then you need to generate the shipping capability to get it to where it needs to go, either to cards you have on the board, which I think all told is probably going to be the most lucrative points-wise, but then also to the board, and the central board has these buildings you can build which give you more income. And that's one of the – balancing that is an interesting puzzle. If you focus too much on the buildings later on in the game, you're apt to suffer. I fell headlong into this trap. Whereas if you don't spend enough time getting your income up to snuff, then you might find yourself unable to fulfill some of those shipping conditions later. That part I thought was really cool. I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's got that great balance, like you were just saying, of getting your delivery capacity up to snuff and getting enough cards out to – fuel that delivery supply.
Absolutely. The part that I really didn't like, though, and this is not so much a question of its age as it is a certain design idiom that you sometimes find in Eurogames, is that the round structure was, I think, smothering. It's one of those Eurogames where it's not as though, oh, it's your turn, do some actions, and we just keep going round and round until the game ends, or even, here's your pool of action points, go ahead and spend them however you like. It was, okay, now we do the phase where we're drafting dice. This will allow you to do some combination of things, which you can do elsewhere, but now's the time when we're drafting dice. Now's the phase where we're playing a tile, and the tile lets you do some of the same things that you could have done while you're drafting dice, but now we're doing it through the drafting of the tile, and now's the phase where you buy extra deliveries. Could you have done that at the same time as normal deliveries? No. That's not the time when you do it. You do it now. And it's not that it's particularly complicated. It just makes it feel cumbersome. I think it also pads the length in an unreasonable way, like an extra 5 minutes that it doesn't really need because you're constantly switching gears. When you compare it to Cryo, and again, in many ways, they're different games. Cryo is an area majority game where you build your own engine and there's some worker placement. Like Valheim instead is sort of a recipe fulfillment slash delivery game. But I very much prefer the flexibility of other Euros that basically say, we'd rather not have like a 10-step round sequence. We'd rather just let you do stuff until the game ends. And Cryo is, that's exactly how it works. On your turn, you place a worker, you bring them back, and you just keep going until an endgame condition is triggered. Like Ranha, on the other hand, is here are the 6 rounds and here are the 10 phases in each round. It's like, So I very much enjoyed it. I thought it was very neat, but I thought that it was enjoyable despite its structure, despite what it did with even the core action selection. Which is weird. I guess that's a testament to the overall quality of the other design elements, because I'm a sucker for a clever action selection and a nice flow. Lagrana had neither, and yet I still enjoyed it.
Agreed. And was the deluxe copy. I think they went a little overboard with the deluxification.
No, please don't use that word, Walker. The company that uses that word doesn't even exist, so why are you keeping
that word?
It's
probably why. It's probably why they do it.
I doubt it.
Anyway. I enjoy having upgraded components, but not every single component like this. Even like the your donkey tiles are upgraded, all the shingles are upgraded.
Yep.
Every single piece of the game had upgraded parts, which I felt were a little unnecessary.
No metal coins,
except for I like the fact that the board was raised up, because I always remember it being a hassle. Your board sort of floated all over the place because you're using cards in 4 different ways. So they're stuck all over your player board. And sometimes if that gets bumped around, it's a pain. But in this case, not so much anymore.
And it is the case that after playing La Granja, all the players said, I would be curious to see how some of the modules work. So there was some curiosity about that. And that is another virtue of the deluxe edition. Now, could this have all fit in one of those great big boxes? So, like, there are some games like Lorenzo il Magnifico and, like, Hansa Teutonica that say they have a big box. When by big, they just mean comprehensive. I think they could have done the same with La Grana, and they didn't. It's a huge box with, as you say, unnecessarily upgraded components. And all told, both in terms of cost and in terms of storage capability, I think that was a mistake. But as it is, we're curious to revisit it. We're curious to see some of the modules, see if they add things to it. As I say, I just wish the round structure were a little less obstreperous. And I wish that it had some sort of interesting action selection mechanism rather than, again, just this laborious sort of now you do this and now you do this and now you do this. But all told, the economic model, the fundamental economic model, was very nice. And very, very enjoyable.
I was going to say, it was very very much named after a philosopher.
Nietzsche. Oh, yeah, I believe the common mispronunciation is Nietzsche. That was how it was mispronounced in the philosophers. No, Nice actually is a region in Italy, and this takes place in Majorca, so I was geographically wrong as well as mispronouncing things.
We got to play a game called Unchained. This was a review copy given to us by the publisher, Trick or Treat Studios. It was designed by David Gregg, who also designed a game that I enjoyed called Nightfall. And this is very similar, but not the same game. Okay? So the key behind Unchained is that when it's your turn, you have a hand of cards, and you can play out a card, and on the side of this particular one, it would tell you what cards you can chain with this card. And so you're trying to get these combinations of cards out that link together. And when you're done, then the next player, when it's not even their turn, also gets to follow your chain. So you're creating this long chain throughout all the players, and then it resolves from the very last player all the way to back to the player whose turn it is, and they all do their things. Now, the main difference between this and Nightfall is the way that this is a deck builder, is the way that you're getting cards into your deck. This is more of like an ascension type deal where you have a big pool of cards and you're taking from this pool. Whereas Nightfall, it was Old Dominion style where you had a set of cards that were out there for the whole game and you purchased from there. And I remember it being a little more interesting, a little more combos that you could get. The cards seemed to do a little bit more unique things. In this particular new Unchained set, it was just a variety of different symbols. So you're making people get tokens, lose tokens, you know, put cards back in your hands. And so it was a little more streamlined in a way. And I still enjoyed it, but not as much as my memories of Nightfall.
Ultimately, the combo system felt entirely arbitrary to me. So there's this notion of player interaction that doesn't really manifest because I don't know what you have in your hand. I don't even really am in a position to know what's in your deck. If I really wanted to, I could possibly try to maintain a spreadsheet in my head of all of the cards you've acquired over the course of an entire game, and therefore try to make an educated guess as to what symbols you're more or less likely to be able to follow in terms of my either adding to the chain or starting a new one. I don't think that someone even with perfect eidetic memory could do this usefully.
I'm not sure if you're supposed to be able to manipulate the chain.
Right, and at that point, what's the point of the chain to begin with? It's just this cumbersome, I just talked about cumbersome round structure. It's just this interminable pause where you're waiting for people to play out cards, also a couple of tokens can move around. At the end of the day, the stakes felt completely drained. I didn't care what anyone else is doing, really, at the end of the day. The interaction that then comes is in terms of the scoring mechanism, which I also despise in both Unchained and in Nightfall. The way the game works is you inflict wounds on people, which are kind of useful, but at the same time not. In Nightfall, they were just strictly advantageous, but they're negative points. In Unchained, it's kind of a double-edged sword, which is kind of interesting. It's one of the two maybe interesting parts of the game, and I'll get to the other one later. Because every time you play one of these useless cards, one of these negative point cards, you draw more cards. That might be nice, but every time you cycle your deck, you get another negative point card. So there's a bit of a tension there about when you want to draw cards. I think that actual decision point was one of the most interesting ones because it's a risk. You increase your effectiveness for the current round in Unchained, but in the process, you dance ever closer to oblivion. But as you're handing out these negative point cards, it's just a series of, again, this weird sort of heuristic of trying to remember what's been going on over the course of the game. How many wounds does who have? What, where? And then most of the time, it's a forced choice. But when it's not a forced choice, when you are able to actually penalize one of several players, I never felt like I was equipped to make an intelligent decision about that. It's like, oh, who whacked me most recently? Or who do I think maybe has been attacked less often? Like, when the final scores were revealed, it was a great surprise to me. And it would have indicated that I might have been picking on the wrong people, which is not a good feeling. It's the worst kind of directed take that spite, broadly speaking. A game like Door of the Lesser Houses, where it's just naked aggression all the time, at least you see visibly who is being predated upon and on what conditions. I never felt like I was able to make an intelligent decision, even on those rare occasions where I had a decision to make. Buying new cards in the market, as you say, how can I build a combo when I don't even really remember the precise distribution of icons that I have in the deck that I had? I feel like in order to make a clever decision in Unchained, I would have had to maintain a spreadsheet, which is not why I play board games, and certainly not a card game of this weight. The other potentially interesting part of Unchained is the hand management, because at the top of your round, you decide to whack somebody. You're obliged to fight. If there's nobody you can whack successfully, instead you get whacked. And then those cards go away. So making sure that you have a tableau of defense, Not so much the offense, but the defense available. There's some interesting tempo with respect to that. Kind of, sort of, but not really. Because if I'm directly downstream of a given player, I know I'm not going to be attacked again by the end of the round. No problem. I can just save all the cards for my turn and then have complete control over what I'm apt to do. The player before that, there's only one person who can control me, and I know what cards they have in front of them. So they're either a threat to me or they're not. And if they're not a threat to me, I'm similarly 100% safe. So you need to be in a four player or higher game in order for this to be a consideration at all in terms of balancing cards on the table versus cards in your hand. And even then, you usually have a good sense of what's going on. So I didn't feel any of that tension that I hoped would manifest. Ultimately, I just felt like I was just the most mechanical shoving cards around. I did not enjoy Unchained.
And then I had a little issue with the theme as well. Old Nightfall was dark and sort of threatening vampires and werewolves.
It was like pretty much straightforward World of Darkness, basically. That's with right. The serial numbers filed off.
And this is more American. What do they call it? American Gothic or American?
No? Universal Monsters.
Universal Monster. Yeah, yeah. Frankenstein and the werewolf and Dracula and that type of thing. So it was a little lighter that way, but it didn't have the same feel.
It also ended up feeling strangely detached from the thematic inspiration as well, because everybody ends up dabbling in all of these different suits by necessity. Unchained kind of forces you to go do that because it maximizes your opportunity to make chains. You don't so much combo into a certain color as you combo across colors, and so you don't really want to over-specialize. And so then, what am I? An invisible werewolf in a black lagoon that drinks blood and is wrapped in mummy wrappings? I don't know. Huey actually made a very excellent suggestion. The nominal theme of the game is that we're all competing to be the assistant or the next entrant into the Universal Monsters, so we're their assistant. The wound cards, instead of being generic fatigue and showing some swooned gentleman with a fabulous mustache, admittedly, they should have been like various demeaning tasks or menial jobs that we had to do for the monsters. Like, go and drain the lagoon, or go and launder the mummy's wraps, or go and clip the werewolf's toenail, whatever. Like, just random amusing stuff that we had to do scut work for the Universal Monsters. So, I wasn't feeling it on any level, really.
I'm looking forward to trying it again, just to see if there is different combinations of cards that you can get that help you along, or, a way to keep your hand size up and still get combos out every time a player starts one. We'll see. Maybe more on Unchained later. And that's Unchained from Trick or Treat Studios.
Paku Paku.
We played Paku Paku again.
So we are now in double Paku. So, I mean, Paku by definition is double. It's just, it's worth stressing. We are now in a position in our hobbyist life where we very explicitly try not to double up on game copies. But you acquired your own copy of Paku Paku, Walker.
I did.
Yes.
I was tired of the tyranny and the withheldness of your Paku Paku copy.
Yeah, you wanted perpetual Paku. You wanted exactly. Paku to always be on hand.
Just so.
So the Paku possibility, perchance.
Oh, I didn't want so much travel on the Paku, you see.
It puts
a lot of pressure on the Paku.
Sedentary Paku.
So now they can just rest and be brought out when the use is required.
Paku Paku is delightful. It's so, Paku Paku is a real-time dice-rolling dexterity game by Antoine Bauza. I mean, that alone should tell you that it is a tiny little box of delights. And we had... This actually was a session without controversy. Sometimes we have not actually had any substantive arguments, which is great because it's always relatively clear where the dice are, what constitutes a fall, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes games that rely on physicality like this, real-time competitive games in general, there's sometimes some degree of ambiguity or disagreement about what's happening. Mostly we just point these things out for fun, but even in this case, it was always very straightforward. And the great thing about Paku Paku is that it is impossible to take it too seriously, even though I will defend it as a game design. I think it's genuinely good. But ultimately, the scoring condition is functional, but the way that it works is points are bad, and whenever you cause the round to end, either because there are too many dice in front of you or because you cause the tower to fall, you just roll all the dice in front of you, and any numbers that show up, those are the points you get. And oh my goodness, the aforementioned Huey, he rolled so many penalty dice. So many, and he just never got any points. It was wild.
Yeah, but it's because there are symbols. The symbols take in effect while you're playing the game. The numbers only take effect when you're
scoring,
getting penalty points. And so he would roll all symbols and get no penalty points. Not Paku justice.
Well, but as a consequence, this led to some Paku strategy.
It's true.
Because normally the idea is you want dice to get away from you as fast as possible. But as it happened, I was rolling the dice and I had the die symbol that said, hand this die to Walker. But that would have caused Walker to end the round and then I knew that Huey would have won. So I'm like, oh, I guess I'll think about what I want to do with this die. And he's like, no, you have to pass it. I'm like, I don't have to do anything. I pass it eventually. I don't need to roll. Generally, it's in my interest to roll as fast as possible, but now it's not, so I'm going to wait until Walker clears his backlog, thank you very much. He was outraged, but the scales fell from his eyes. He knew possibilities in Paku Paku. Again, Paku Paku by Antoine Boza, published by Ravensburger in 2017.
So this week, we streamed again, and we streamed a whole bunch of smaller games. So we did Turbo Kids, we did 9 Tiles Panic, we did 5 Towers, we did Clip Cut Parks, and we did the same game. I'll save the same game to the end because Mark got a chance to try it as well. But I'll go quickly through all these games because they're all on the stream. If you want to watch them, you can go to our YouTube page and look under the live tab and you can check these games out. Turbo Kids was fantastic. It played just the way I wanted it to. There was 4 of us, so it was 2 teams of 2. One person has a blindfold on and has a dry erase marker on a racetrack and puts their thumb up like Fonzie. The other player manipulates their thumb like a joystick while they draw along the track, and you use verbal commands and the joystick to make them go around corners and avoid mines, and you're racing against the other team, and it was fantastic. This is designed by Emmanuel Galvin and published by Hatchet Board Games USA, and it was everything I wanted it to be. It has like over 16 tracks that you can play with jumps and mines and all sorts of silly stuff, oil slicks, fun stuff to come.
I am so jealous that I have not had a chance to try Turbo Kids yet. There are 2 major obstacles to getting it to the table for us, and I think these are worth flagging. One of them is it seems very clearly designed for either 4 or 6 players. Odd numbers are not great. Less than 4 isn't great.
Even 6 is no good. It does not come with 3 sets of tracks.
No, but you play 2 sets, and what you do is you divvy up the
you do,
one person gives the verbal commands and one person operates the joystick.
True.
I'd be willing to try that.
Yeah, true. But I still think it's ideal for.
Yes, ideal at 4. And number 2, this is not the kind of game I would feel comfortable so much as suggesting to strangers, because it involves prolonged physical contact with someone who has a blindfold on and general physical proximity generally. And it's not that I'm in any way uncomfortable about physical proximity, but I would never ever want to put someone in a social position where they might internalize pressure to be okay with a situation that they might not be okay with.
Yes.
Some people don't like being loomed over. Some people don't want to be touched, certainly not in a prolonged period like that. And they certainly don't want to be in public with all those conditions while being blindfolded. Amongst friends, no problem. I would happily submit to those circumstances. But to somebody I don't know real well, I'd feel very unwilling to suggest a game like Turbo Kids. And so consequently, it's given that we're not often at 4 players in our group, it's going to be awkward. But I'm very much looking forward to trying it.
Next up is an oink game called 9 Tiles Panic. And this is another... All these games are fantastic. In this game, everyone has the same sort of goals. You have 9 tiles that have roads on them. And they all, you know, Catan style, all come out in the middle or either end. So you can design this different road section, or some are blank, you know, you can go blank to blank, but all the roads, like in Catan, have to connect properly. There's also aliens along the road. There are
naturally
sort of X-Factor guys, or, you know, XCOM guys, you know, chasing the aliens. There are dogs, there are houses. So when you flip up goal cards, there's going to be all sorts of goals, like everyone has their own set of 9 tiles. They're double-sided. So you're going to flip up 3 goal cards, and it could be anything from having the most houses to the most curves in your road to all your roads being the same length, having aliens, anyway, all sorts of different goals. You flip over the timer, and then you get to arrange your 9 tiles however you like, but it does have to be a 3x3 grid. And so you're trying to score as many of those goal cards as you can, all in that 3x3 grid. And then it's... What was it? Like tiny turbo cars. You're grabbing, if you're out first, you want to get the first token as well, because that's the tiebreaker if you tie for any of those goal conditions.
Right.
That is also very important, which is fantastic. And then the last player fortunately sort of gets a bonus because they can look around and see what people are doing, and they just have to get done before the timer comes out. They're going to get the last thing, but they have some extra time to move around their tiles. Then you score it. Fantastic game.
That sounds wonderful.
It is really good. And then
do you know why nine tiles panic? Because 7, 8, 9.
Oh, yes. That's
gold right there.
It's quality content.
I would just like to point out to the listeners and to anyone else that might be aware of this, you cannot take back our Golden Geek Award.
It's true. Non-refundable.
For the record.
You'll never get it on my cold hands. We also played Five Towers. It played very well at 4. I think this is my favorite game of Five Towers. I think it's Sean a little bit better at 4. It was very much losing its luster in the last few times we played it. It's fine, but it's very much you're just going to bid what you need, and if someone beats you, then it doesn't really matter because you didn't need that many cards. It's just it's a weird game, but it is fun to play. You're building these 5 different colored towers. Your pool of cards, 5 cards will come up, and you bid on how many cards that you want and or can fit on your personal play area. And then someone can outbid you, but they have to take all the cards. Anyway, everyone enjoyed that one. This is designed by Casper Lapp, which we enjoy, put out by Deep Print Games. Then we played a very interesting game that is going to be hard to explain. This is called Clip Cut Parks, designed by Sean Graham, Scott Huntington, and put out by Renegade Game Studios. You have this piece of paper that has this giant, I believe it's 7x9 grid of different types of terrain. Desert, water, housing, stuff like that. And you have a pair of scissors. Then you have your own personal playing card sorts of grids of city blocks. They're usually like different sort of Tetris shapes. There could be bridges in between them. And someone's going to roll a single die. And it's going to see either it might be like a 4 or a 2-2-1 or a 1-1-1. And this is how many cuts you can take the scissors and cut into your little sheet of paper. And they have to be straight cuts. And anything that falls off or you make cut off, you get to fit onto your cards. And if there's bridges between the squares, it means that it has to be a continuous piece of paper. And if you can't put it on your cards, then it's a shame thing. You sort of crumple it up and you put it beside you as a token. And it's a fantastic little game because there's also like sometimes the actual squares have to line up to the right colors, or there's symbols on the cards,
so it's a tiling game where you're cutting out the tiles.
Yes.
From a wild.
It is very
utterly wild.
Very much enjoyed it, even though very much schooled by Sidewinder, but still was great.
Sidewinder will school you.
It's true. And that is Clip Cut Parks. And lastly, we got to play The Same Game. The Same Game is very interesting. It has sort of these large tiles of sort of broad categories, like length or weight or volume or importance to the world or frequency throughout the world or
height when laid down.
Yes, all sorts of generic sort of
criteria.
And then everyone gets a human-made object, like, say, skateboard. And all of those criteria are numbered. So you'll get a number 7, which is length. And you have skateboard. So you have to come up with a word.
Another human-made
object that is the same length as the skateboard, but won't really fit into the other categories when associated with a skateboard.
Yes, it's a cooperative game where you're trying to come up with another object that will cause other people to not pick the one that has been set up as the trap. So in the case of skateboard and length, what I want to do is find an object that is as dissimilar to the skateboard as possible in all respects of the criteria on the table, except for length.
Yeah, so you want to make sure, because one thing could be price. So the thing you pick, you don't want it to be the same price as a skateboard. Stuff like that.
Which, of course, raises the excellent question, how much is a skateboard?
Exactly.
What kind of skateboard?
Yes, and these are the discussions I was hoping that would come up, and they did.
They did,
many
yeah.
Many things. Like, one of the key ones was, are there more cars or smartwatches worldwide?
Yes, and I've been quizzing more people, and basically what I've discovered is that for people who do not own everyone who does not own a smartwatch will respond unambiguously cars. Everyone who does own a smartwatch will respond unambiguously smartwatch and be wrong. Because we actually looked it up, and even by the most optimistic measures, There are twice as many cars, roughly, as there are smartwatches in the world. And that is assuming, parenthetically, that none of these smartwatches have ever been thrown away. That's the crucial thing, right? Because the number is just the total number of smartwatches that have been sold over the course of human existence. Dewey, in particular, was expressed great outrage at the notion that there could be more cars than smartwatches in the world. And his observation was that he had three, and so therefore everyone would have multiples. My observation was that there are a lot of people who are even very technically inclined who don't care to have a smartwatch. And anyway.
And I was outraged at the fact that someone thought the hockey puck or that the beanbag had more worldly impact than the hockey puck.
Importance to humanity, I think, was the criterion. And I, for one, Walker, am, as always, shocked and outraged by your hipster erasure. If not for the beanbag, what would hipsters do with their times? How would they hacky their sack? What sack would they hacky? It would be impossible, Walker. And I, for one, the stoners as well. Who is going to stand up for the stoners and the hipsters, if not me? I do not belong to those groups, but I have a great deal of sympathy for groups that I do not belong to.
It's so good. So when it's your turn, you flip up your word and your clue, and then the rest of the team, because this is a cooperative game, have to sort of plink out all the ones that it is not. And you get to put the cups on the board, which is
the unnecessary,
like, crazy components that are the cups. And then it increases your score that you're going to get until you hit the trap. The trap being the actual, you know, matchup.
Yeah, the one that you were randomly assigned that you were trying to avoid.
Yeah. So, and it's easy to, I shouldn't say it's easy to teach because it is a little different than everything else.
It's a little conceptually confusing. Like, several people at the table had the same confusions that gradually were cleared up.
Yeah, and this will be, I'm sure, will be talked about later because we're going to talk about rules. This is very much a game that I always set up.
With an example.
With it, like a turn. So we play a turn, and I think that really shows exactly how it's going to play out, and I think makes it flow a little faster than trying to just explain verbally.
I might elaborate on this later in Bloat. I think this would be too much of a digression, even by my standards, for the main show, but the rules have an interesting notion about what constitutes a compound, because like any cooperative word game or even competitive word game, you have to have a discussion about what is an acceptable clue. And frequently it's a word. And in this context, they say it's a word, but then they say that compounds are okay, and their definition of compound is an interesting one. But setting all that aside, the thing that I find most striking, honestly, about the same game is that it is entirely limited to human-made objects. That part is strange. And furthermore, it is limited to human-made objects, and you're not allowed to make reference to the material out of which it is made. So the example in the rulebook is cooking spoon is fine, wooden spoon is not. And I don't know why that choice was made. I don't have any objection to that choice. It's an interesting framing. I don't know why necessarily it was done. I might have a better sense if I saw the other criteria. But as a way to limit the universe of available objects, it's a very distinctive one. It leads to the kinds of plays and the kinds of considerations you want out of a game of this ilk. Interesting discussions, some interesting comparison sets, thinking outside the box, trying to not make unnecessary inferences that other players will make. It was impressive.
I think that's one of the reasons why they made it that way. It focuses down onto objects that will invoke discussion, whereas if you left it wide open, you could sort of maybe
start talking about ideas and then people get nervous.
Cherry pick things and it would make it much easier. Yeah.
A cherry picker, that's an object.
Just so.
Yeah. So this was designed by Wolfgang Warsch, he of Quacks of Quedlinburg, all the clever games, as well as Wavelength. So given that he was involved in Wavelength, I'm not shocked that he designed a very solid entry in this category. Wolfgang Warsch, he's an interesting designer, and he definitely casts a wide net for some of his inspirations. Published by Edition Spielweise last year, 2023. That is the same game. We get to try Omen, Songs of Far Shores. So this is basically one of the three new Omen sets that John Cloudus of Smallbox Games crowdfunded. This is a review copy we got from the designer. There are three sets. We started with set number one. You can mix and match them. You can play a given set by itself. You can do all kinds of different game modes. We just played the first set.
Yeah, this way I was very confused at what we're supposed to call this. Like, when you buy it, do you get all the sets? So you just call it the Omen game? And then it has, like, the subsets?
No, this is Omen Songs of Far Shores. That is what the first deck is called. The other decks have their own names.
They do. But I'm just wondering, like, they always come together, though. Do they come together, or are people going to buy them separately, or?
In the crowdfunding, they were sold collectively all at once. And in the grand tradition of small box games, as they do for many of their releases, you could get the print and play, or you get the normal version, or you could get a deluxe version. The deluxe version comes with, of course, metal coins. And I have no idea what the plans are for broader retail distribution. At any rate, Omen has been floating around for over a decade in various versions. It has always been John Cloudus's most mainstream and widely available card game. But it, nonetheless, like all of his card games, is unambiguously a game of ridiculous combos and blowout turns of special abilities. So I don't, it's weird, I don't know if I enjoy Omen as much as I enjoy The North. The North may still be my favorite John Cloudus design because The North is more clearly abstracted in a way that makes me appreciate the fact that all that I'm doing is combining the cards together in very focused ways. And I also feel like when playing The North that we're both playing with basically the same deck because it's a universe of effects that is repeated across both of us and it's a question of leveraging them more effectively. The Omen games feature a variety of unique effects that are sufficiently different from each other that I sometimes feel like we're playing with entirely different decks. That, you know, we could separate out the decks at the start, and you'd be playing with half, and I'd be playing with half. And furthermore, it is kind of sort of aping the same sort of setup as, say, Smash Up or Blood Bowl Team Manager, or even something like Shot and Totten, where you're fighting over terrain in the middle with a card-based game, but you're not really. It doesn't really leverage the same kind of dynamics. So partially, I think every time I play Omen, and I've played previous editions before, I get a little confused. Now, this is not to say that this is a fault of the design, and I'm very curious to try the other sets in Omen, and indeed some of the other variety of ways to play Omen, because I very much enjoy Omen. I like the effects. I like all the way that it does. The information presentation is not ideal because there's a large universe of available keywords that the rulebook has to make you internalize, but any given set is only going to have a subset of those keywords, and so it can be a little disorienting to try to approach the game from start if you don't know which subset you're going to be dealing with.
The one thing I do enjoy about it is the fact that a lot of the abilities are general, as in apply this to a card, where a lot of these games it's always to your card. So a lot of times you're affecting the other side of the board, and it seems at first it seems out of place, but then you realize it was all meant to be this way. It has interesting timing considerations, like a lot of cards will key off of, I think it's support.
Bolster.
And it'll require another card with bolster being out. So sometimes you might want to hesitate putting out these bolster cards that will help you, but then you know that they're going to start triggering a bunch of cards that they have in their hand with their bolster as well.
Yes, exactly. And on top of that, there are other ways to score. I focused on the alternative ways to score, whereas Walker focused on holding me upside down and dunking my head repeatedly in a toilet, demanding my lunch money. It turns out that approach was more successful, at least in this instance. I have to say, well done. And I thoroughly enjoy John Cloudus's design aesthetic. I find that if you're going to do lots of wild combos, I appreciate the relatively light rules overhead, the small form factor, and the quick playing time. I don't want to be stuck in a 90 to 120 minute Euro game where someone's turn takes 5 minutes and you're constantly sitting there waiting to see if their turn is done. Or even a shorter game, you know, not entirely unlike my complaints about Unchained. I very much enjoyed Omen, and I'm looking forward to trying it some more.
Another card game that we got to play is The Veil of Eternity. This is designed by Eric Hong and put out by Mandu Games. And this is another sort of tableau builder. You are drawing a bunch of cards that could be all sorts of different elements and or dragon. And then you're doing sort of, I don't want to say furnace style, but it felt like furnace for whatever reason. You're putting out tokens to sort of save cards for yourself. And it goes in snake pattern.
And it's basically a kind of a draft, except yeah. The cards that you're quote-unquote drafting in this phase, you're not committed to either playing, much less drawing them. Some of them you may discard to generate resources. Some of them you may take into your hand. It's up to you.
Yeah, so once you put out the tokens, like Mark said, you get to do actions. It could be sell the card, take the card into your hand, play the card out. And it also has this interesting sort of sort of restrictions on your income. You're allowed to have 4 stones, and the stones can be anywhere from 1, 3, or 6 points. And so you're trying to manipulate how many, you know, you can only have 4 out, so I'll get rid of these ones and keep the 6s, or overpay for things because you don't get change. You can never cash them in to get the bigger ones. So it's an interesting way to sort of manage that.
You're also restricted in that your tableau can contain no more cards than the number of the round. And this does not necessarily entail every round you'll be playing out one card, although frequently in the game, the one game that I've played, it did shake out to be that way. Now, this does increase the universe of available effects, so suddenly that card that you play that lets you discard other cards from your tableau is very, very useful, especially if you played out a one-shot that scored you a whole bunch of points. You don't need it anymore. It can go away. My principal objection to the Veil of Eternity is precisely that the cards that generate you points come out at random intervals. And maybe the card that is going to be very, very valuable for multiple players comes out in a turn where you're earlier in the turn order. Sometimes it won't. And consequently, it felt like in terms of actually advancing my victory conditions, it went in fits and starts. And I felt more at the mercy of what cards were available to draft and where I was in turn order than anything else that actually happened. And so I felt that to be very, very much to its detriment, especially when you consider the fact that when it comes to relatively quick drafting and or tableau building games, there are many games designed by Tom Lehman that are just, in my estimation, flatly better. So I would vastly prefer playing something like Res Arcana than Veil of Eternity, both because I feel like it's more under my control and because I think that the economy is genuinely more interesting, not based around a series of artificial limits and not constrained my ability to play cards, even though, as I say, you do get the benefit of some extra card effects in the universe. But at the end of the day, I didn't think that what we were doing was particularly interesting. There were some interesting combos that you can generate. I had a couple of cards that turned my 3s into 6s, and then I played other cards that benefit off my 6s, and I had lots of 6s, even though they're normally hard to come by because 3s are easy to come by. Anyway, I just didn't like the way scoring worked, all told, and I felt some of the restrictions to be gimmicky rather than substantive, and it's a very competitive design space.
Yep, so the Veil of Eternity is not on Board Game Arena, so don't go to Board Game Arena to try it out.
This is Walker speak for it's available in alpha. For those of you that do not speak fluent Walker, I'm not fluent in Walker.
No, I think it's out on regular. I'm just tired of promoting them and not getting a check, that's all.
See, even I don't speak fluent Walker. I've been subjected to this for how many years, and I still don't get it. There are idioms, and the inflection, my accent for one thing, is terrible, and I just can't quite grasp. Anyway,
that is the Veil of Eternity. Fabulous art, and it has this marvelous standee that's essential to gameplay.
Yeah, Here's the thing. And this isn't so much the Veil of Eternity's fault. This is a very, very common sin. I am sick to death of game publishers, and I don't know if game designers specifically are to blame, I'd be surprised, but it may be their fault too, of deliberately including things and cards and references in the rulebook and components that are explicitly designed to be part of a buzz marketing campaign so that you'll go take pictures of you sitting, standing, or gesturing next to various board game components. It specifically says in the front of the rulebook for Veil of Eternity, this standee is, well, I'm reading between the lines, this standee is useless, it doesn't do anything, but it'll look great in the pictures of our game, wink, wink. Why didn't you help us market this thing? Ah, made me disgusted before the game even started.
So glad. Veil of Eternity.
We played Sentinels of the Multiverse by Christopher Bodell, Paul Bender, Adam Rabataro, Greater Than Games. This is the second edition of Sentinels of the Multiverse. We have not yet tried the definitive edition, which is the more recent one that got crowdfunded in 2022. Someday I'm sure one of us will try it to determine that our massive monolith obelisk of everything from the second run of the game will suffice and we don't need to rebuy everything for the third run.
Have we not read something about it? I think it's just they cleaned up the wording a bit. I think we're good.
The wording has been cleaned up and the art styles have been altered such that the style of the art will match the time in which the character was introduced in their kayfabe comics universe, so that specifically the card art will not match across different decks, which does not, to me, seem like an advantage. I actually really like the art in Sentinels of the Multiverse. I like that it all matches. I like that it presents a consistent comics universe. Anyway, Set into the Multiverse is one of our perennial favorite games, even though we don't necessarily defend a lot of its design decisions. This was actually a very, very, very good setup for Sentinels of the Multiverse. We were fighting against the Ennead and in the Celestial Tribunal, and all told, the effects were reasonably manageable, largely by virtue of the fact that, number one, we divide up the responsibilities. It's very crucial to do this. Someone has to run the boss and know exactly what the boss is doing, and someone else has to run the environment and know exactly what the environment is doing. And we chose a bunch of characters that just happened to be perfect for dealing with them.
The poor Ennead, yes.
Yeah. We really beat them like they stole something. Now, this shows, I think, Sentinels of the Multiverse at its best and also at its worst. At its best, it lets you do a whole bunch of cool effects and feel like you're doing synergistic stuff and the threat comes up and like, oh, I have a tool in my toolbox to deal with that. At its worst, though, it demonstrates that a lot of this is just incredibly arbitrary.
Yeah, but I think if this was a game to show someone Sentinels of the Multiverse, it would have been fantastic. Because a lot of times, you're playing your own thing, right? It's like, I'm going to do damage, and then they're going to do damage. We were giving each other DR. We were letting each other draw cards.
Yes.
There was the synergy that was going on in this game was much out of place than normal.
You say synergy, I say power creep. We had a number of, I had forgotten entirely that the hero that I picked, because I hadn't played him in a while, is from one of the heroes from the Oblivion set. Now, we don't like the Oblivion game mode. It's one of the worst experiences I've ever had, gaming experience I've ever had in my life, seeing this game transformed into a four-hour monstrosity of pain. But all the heroes in the Oblivion set, which you can play in any game mode, are very potent. I'm always of two minds. Half of me thinks that this is an indication of overall power creep, but the other half of me remembers that in the base set, they already had Wraith and Legacy, so it's tough to tell. But the long and the short of it is, just as an example, a couple of examples of how, you know, the best of times, the worst of times. In terms of the best of times, once we defeated Set from the Ennead, the Ennead is a bunch of mini-bosses, his effect was, at the top of each of his turns, every round, it would cause the top deck of every deck to get played. What that means is, top card of the boss deck, top card of Huey's deck, top card of Louie's deck, top card of my deck, etc., 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 which is wild. But relatively easy to execute. Sometimes we would remember what stage we were. Louis in particular was like, is it my turn? It's like, no. Huey just did something, but it's still the boss's turn. At the worst of times, though, the Celestial Tribunal would set up these tribunals where thematically it was cool. Various human superheroes from Earth were on the dock, and if they were being tortured by various interrogators, and if they died, we would instantly lose because we were judged to be failure as a species and get wiped out. If we had not had very specific cards, because getting rid of environment cards, anybody who's played Sentinels of the Multiverse, some heroes can do it easily, some heroes can't do it at all. It's very easy to have a setup that would not have been able to get rid of environment cards that easily. We had three heroes that could get rid of environment cards real easily, and a couple more.
Ones, yeah.
And a couple more that could get rid of it sometimes. If none of those had been around, it would have been an insta-loss.
Yes.
So there you go. The best of times, the worst of times. Sentinels of the Multiverse. We had a great time, but you have to... I'm at the point now with Sentinels where it's like, I will happily play any day of the week. And I will expect it to be just one of those flip a card, see what happens kinds of games, honestly.
Because when you think about what it is, it's like, you know, 30 different heroes with 15 different bosses and 30 different environments that all sort of mash together in some weird, crazy way and usually work out in a half decent way.
Usually.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, though. When I compare Sentinels of the Multiverse to Street Masters, Street Masters, in terms of the solidity of the gameplay, has Sentinels beat by a country mile. It is also the case that when there is any kind of complication in terms of targeting, Street Masters is also vastly easier and more straightforward to execute. There are only two things that give the edge to Sentinels when compared to Street Masters. One of them is playtime, especially at higher play counts. Street Masters just gets longer the more players you add, whereas Sentinels rather can go to five, and you're not really going to be dragging much. And the other is theme. Street Masters is just a collection of various references to video game characters and other popular characters. There's a kind of an attempt to make a universe, but it doesn't really appeal to me. The Sentinels universe I find very appealing. But in terms of actual gameplay, that's not why I'm there. It can be done. Street Masters shows us that it can be done. If Street Masters had the theming of Sentinels of the Multiverse, oh my goodness. Alas.
Alas. And that is Sentinels Multiverse, designed by Christopher Bale, Paul Bender, and Adam Rabataro, published by Greater Than Games. And that's all the games we played this week. Now a quick break to pay the bills.
It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney+, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be in the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free.
And we're back with the news and why it does not matter. So Mark, Ninja Division. Have you heard of Ninja Division?
I have.
It's a gaming company. They have filed for bankruptcy. And unfortunately, they have two very big Kickstarters still yet to fulfill. They have one called Relic Knight 2nd Edition that had 2,489 backers, 386,000 and change. They also had their main game. So people that have heard of Arcadia Quest, there's a very similar game that they put out called Super Dungeon Legends, this one. This one had 6,611 backers with 1,290,000 and change. So that was supposed to fulfill in 2016.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it did not fulfill.
It did not fulfill, huh?
And Relic Knight 2nd Edition was supposed to come out in February of 2018. They had a game out called Ninja All-Stars, which I played, which I thought was great. And for those who don't know any of those games, it's like sort of like a chibi type style. They had like a soda pop miniature line that they put out all these miniatures for. So it's too bad that these people are not going to get their stuff. Hopefully it will be picked up by someone like these other Kickstarters. It seems to be the decade of failed crowdfunding, but we'll see.
There's going to be another expansion to the Mage Knight board game called Apocalypse Dragon. WizKids is going back to the well. I, for one, am very happy. Now, granted, it's not going to be designed by Vlada Kavadil himself. It's being designed by Phil Pettifer, but he did the design work on Shades of Tesla, and this is being supervised or blessed or something by Vlada Kavadil. It's always tough to tell what that actually means. Does that mean that he looked over anything? Does that mean he just waved his hand over something and magically declassified them? I don't know. It's tough to tell. But I'm very curious to see what they do. Now, granted, I'm somewhat disappointed that now my very, very well done insert is now not going to fit everything, but such are the burdens that we bear.
Yeah, there'll be a new character. That's all I care about. You know, all the other stuff is fluffy, whatever, but
okay.
New padding, but checking out a new character is always fun.
It's good to have priorities.
Lastly for me, I enjoy Star Realms. There's going to be an IP version of Star Realms. Now you can play Star Trek Star Realms. How exciting.
I can buy that.
Yeah.
Which universe? General or
I'm not sure. It's in early days.
Oh, okay.
We will see.
Finally, for me, some listeners pointed out, based on my discussion of one of my drafts in the Patreon popularity poll pick, which is a strange segment at the beginning of the unedited versions of the episodes, that Magical Athlete is actually going to be reprinted by CMYK. CMYK, they of Wavelength, They Break, Lacuna, Spots, and other great games. Magical Athlete is designed by Takashi Ishida and is the best roll and move game I've ever played. It is a very charming game. It's been a cult favorite for a long time, and apparently CMYK plans on reprinting it next year. I, for one, am very happy. Get to expose Walker to Magical Athlete.
Can't wait.
So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now on to our topic, which is rules explanations. You know, the amount of time that your average hobbyist spends either explaining rules or having rules explained to them, it's remarkable that people aren't better at it.
It's true. But my first two points might be the reason.
Okay. Sock it to me.
People just ingest information differently.
It is true.
Everyone understands things at a different speed and in a different way. Not only that, people's memories work differently. So they can internalize some facts easier or keep track of certain facts differently than other people do.
That is true. One thing, though, that I find remarkable, and I've observed this as a student, I've observed this as a teacher, and I've observed this as a hobbyist, is that there can come a moment, and I'm not trying to blame the individuals who do this, but there can come a moment where someone has convinced themselves that they cannot understand something. Doesn't matter how complicated it is, doesn't matter how approachable it is, doesn't matter how many times you explain to them, there comes a tipping point. You can sometimes see it in their eyes. They've decided they can't get it, and they're never going to get it.
Yeah, that's why you never say, like, oh, this game's complicated, right off the beginning.
Would say it's also why you never say this game's simple. Because the problem is when you preface it, either this is, if you say it's complicated, somebody's like, oh, I'm never going to get it. But if you say it's really simple and they don't get it at first, then sometimes they shut down. Now, I violate this advice all the time. And sometimes I say, oh, this game is very simple. I think it's a trap either way.
It's true. And this doesn't mean that, you know, you force complicated games on people. This is more like what I'm about to say next is, like, know your audience.
Yes.
Don't start a game explanation to people you know are not going to enjoy it, or you don't think are going to grasp it, or it's not at their, you know, it's like, oh, we've played Monopoly of, you know, all week. Now suddenly we're going to play Brass. It's this, you know, it has money in it. So it's the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. You own property and you put things out. It's basically the same game. They're all basically Mage Knight. So.
And not only know the people that you're explaining to it, I saw another point today that was makes a lot of sense. It's the timing as well. Say you're on a games day and it's now, you know, 11 p.m. You know, don't say, okay, now it's time to fresh teach Gaia Project. You know, it's like that late at night when everyone is, you know, tired and done.
Yep.
Pick a game that everyone already knows.
Yes. And part of the problem is I sometimes hear people say, oh, you know, what? Try to imagine a halcyon universe where rules explanations are not necessary. Generally speaking, I find that even people who play the same small number of games over and over and over again, they still need the refresher because otherwise they forget. It's wild. I mean, yeah, there are some instances, absolutely, where you can break out a perennial favorite game and just hit the ground running. But honestly, I'm always amazed at the frequency of people saying, oh, yeah, we play this all the time. We don't need rules. Yeah, you probably do. It's because you don't want that. Those moments of surprise later in the game, whether it's because the rules explainer forgot something, whether it's because there wasn't a rules explanation, whether it's because someone misunderstood, those moments of surprise, they're fraught and it's difficult and best to be avoided. Of course, the techniques how best to avoid it are complicated and sundry, but. Can I have a soapbox moment? Walker?
You sure can, Mark. Let me help you up there.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Got your balance? You're good? Okay.
Yeah, I am. My balance is impeccable.
Oh, good stuff.
I want the hobby to progress to a time, to an attitude, to a cultural standard, to an expectation that not thanking the rules explainer would kind of like being going to a restaurant and not tipping your server. It's a thing that will happen, but is the act of a monster. Because this is a thankless job that no one that I've ever met enjoys. I'm sure there may be some people that enjoy it, and I'm not saying you're a freak if you do, but I've never met anyone who says to enjoy it. At best, I've seen people who don't mind it that much. It is necessary for the hobby, and consequently, it brings so much joy, directly and indirectly, to so many people. And it's very difficult to do, and it goes unacknowledged. I mean this sincerely. It goes unacknowledged all the time. If somebody stands up to bring you a drink from a fridge, you thank them. If somebody spends an hour, 2 hours, maybe more, internalizing a rule set, and then however long to actually explain it to you and answer your questions and helping the game run, I am appalled. And I'm guilty of this too. People do not thank rules explainers. And I hope I'm saying this not because I happen to be the primary rules explainer of our group often. It's just remarkable to me how much effort goes into it, how difficult it is, and how unacknowledged and underappreciated it goes. Because, as we've observed many times, if anything goes wrong, if you forget anything, people will serve crap to you on a nice little silver platter.
Oh, they turn on you quick.
Oh, they'll turn on you. Well, I agree with you, but it's not even really turning on you because they were never on your side. No, that's just it. It's not like, thank you very much for explaining this. Oh, but you did it wrong. Let me bring out the dagger. No, it was, I am neutral and I'm not acknowledging the thing you're doing. Oh, but you didn't do it perfectly. I'm coming for you. It's really quite appalling. As somebody for whom ingratitude is a big deal for me, I find it really quite galling that there's this generalized attitude of, yeah, rules explanations and rules explainers are the backbone and lifeblood of the hobby. We're not going to do anything so petty and gauche as say thank you. It's quite striking. So here's the policy that I've tried to internalize. After any game, you congratulate who won if it wasn't you, or you say good job to your colleagues if you're playing a co-op and you won, or whatever, or good job to your colleagues after you lose if they did something cool or invent that they do, and you thank whoever explained the game regardless of how good bad a job you did and mean it. And if you don't mean it, something's wrong with you. This is my position, and I want people to join me in this position. Insofar as I wield any influence, I want this to become a cultural norm.
I agree.
Thank you, Walker. Thank you again for explaining the rules. I hope I thanked you for every rules explanation you've given me over the past couple weeks.
I hope I thanked you, Mark.
Huh?
I said, and I hope I've thanked you.
Not really, but you're an ungrateful turd, so.
It's true.
Yeah.
I gotta live up to expectations, Mark. All right, then you gotta sometimes throw the theme out the door. Unless the theme actually helps teach the game. There are some games where the theme sort of brings you along and makes things more understandable, but in the case that it doesn't, then sometimes it gets in the way. So chuck it.
Yeah, I agree. I often find myself, and sometimes it's unfortunate to do this, but if you don't have to be married to technical terminology, use whatever terms people happen to be throwing about. Sometimes you have to correct them. It's like a particular example for me is when I'm explaining the rules to Cerebria, the inside world. It's like, okay, guys, you're going to be tempted to use the word upgrade for things that are not upgrades. I'm sorry, we're going to have to use upgrade only for upgrades. The other things are enhancements or whatever they're called. But the rest of the time, it's like, oh, you're making something better? It's like, oh, the rules call it an intensification. It's like, call it an upgrade if you want to. Who cares? Sometimes you do one and forget that you actually need the technical terms. I've said this a million times, but I'll never forget it. On a couple of different occasions, I thought I could do that to El Grande, and then I remember, oh, wait, there's text on the action cards. I can't call them cubes. I have to call them caballeros. Of course, you don't even use cubes in El Grande anymore. They're meeples now, but you take my point.
I do. And I said this last time we talked about rule books, but I'll say it again. Not so long ago, our group would get together and we'd take the wrapper off the game and say, okay, page one. And we'd sit and learn the book. And that just is frightening to me now. And so knowing the game, if you are going to be the person that explains it, you need to know the game and you need to be confident and you need to pause every so often and ask anyone if they have any questions so far. Don't be upset if they interrupt you. Just means that you haven't paused enough for them to ask questions.
That's probably one of my biggest shortcomings as a rules explainer. I have it in my head. I think one of my strengths as a rules explainer is that I have a plan about how to organize the information. And I do so in a deliberate manner, and I don't do things randomly, like in a stochastic manner. It's like, okay, well, here's how combat works. And I'll talk about how getting into fights 10 minutes from now. And here's the income phase. The income phase happens at the end. And, oh, at the top of your turn, you draw your hand. And, you know, things like that. That drives me nuts. I try to be a good recipient of a rules explanation and try to grapple with a slew of chaos that many people seem to give out. But because my number one piece of advice to people explaining rules is do things in a sensible order. And to my mind, the natural order for many games, not all, but many, is here is what a round and a turn looks like and introduce them in order and present those things. And
yeah,
deviate from that pattern only when need be.
That's why I love when there's player aids. I love when there's player aids. You make sure that people have them and they follow along. So then they can do some association and know where you are and understand what's going on.
That, I think, is another thing that I need to keep in mind more often, which is when I'm teaching a new game, look to see what player aids are available. Because rule books are often very bad at flagging what the player aids tell you. And so I find myself frequently in a position of not organizing my rules explanation to the player aid, or when internalizing the rules for the first time, because that's the first step of doing a rules explanation, internalizing the rules, I don't know what it is that people are going to need to remember and what it is they can refer to. I'm so bad at this that I've made the same mistake for the same game multiple times. Talked about Tank Duel, Enemy in the Crosshairs a couple weeks ago. Well, they have excellent player aids that walk through everything, and every time I've read the rulebook, I'm like, wow, this is a lot of information that I'm going to have to remember. No! Take out the player aid! Figure out what you need to do, and everyone will follow along. I agree entirely. Now, sometimes the player aids are trash, but most of the time they're pretty good.
I always like to give like a turbo overview of the game as well. Like go through a whole turn as quickly as possible, just so they get a flow of the game. So when you do explain things, they can sort of put the piece in where, what kind of implications that this action will do. It's like you can go with this whole thing about fighting and combat and how it does. And if they don't understand what implications that has, it's sort of hard to grasp how important it is. So if you do like a quick, very general overview, and then they can put the more pieces into place.
I think that's one of those areas where there's more room for personal variation, like what comes naturally to your explanation. I tend to be very sparse in the global overview, unless it's the kind of thing where there's a billion different kinds of actions, but you really need to understand the end state. Most of the time, I think you can just fall out naturally. The exception is victory conditions. If I can stress what it is that you're trying to do, what it is that will help you win, the overall goal of the game, that is absolutely something I'll stress at the outset, independently of wherever else it might fall.
And then there's two big points. I put here splatter rules and okay. Cards or actions that will change how the game is played. So this is sort of like action cards, or you know that there's going to be an event card that will come up that will slowly go against everything you're explaining in the game now. Something that will come up.
Sure.
Or might come up, might not come up. Something that's going to drastically change the way the game's played. They should get, you know, sort of a warning that might happen.
It's a balancing act, though, because one of the things that rubs me the wrong way in rules explanations is the rules explainer who's like, okay, well, this is how the game works, but then, well, this card does that thing, and this card does this other thing, and this card does this other thing, and this one time I played with Fred, and the card came out, and then Sally did the thing, and then suddenly you just lose the threat.
Oh, yeah, if there's that many, then yes, that's definitely a problem.
Agreed.
But
agreed.
If there's just one, and then there's the splatter rules, where if the player can make a huge mistake at the beginning,
yeah,
and spend all their money, do the Monopoly, you know, and spend $1,500 on their first piece of real estate, you know, chime in and say, you know, try not to do this right away. This might be a problem. Don't spend too much money because, you know, money's very tight, stuff like that.
Well, with respect, this raises a perennial issue. We've talked about this a bunch of times before. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts once again. And that is, how much during a rules explanation do you give strategy advice? In the context of a splatter game, I frequently give far, far more than I normally would. But often then, it's not even during the rules explanation, it's when they start taking their first turns, right? When in the case of Food Chain Magnet, their first hire. In the context of Antiquity, where they happen to be building, stuff like that. And just be like, just so you know, the implication of that is X, Y, and Z. And I vastly prefer that tone to the tone that some other people do. It's like, you should really do this. Do this X. I did it in my last game. It worked out real well. And they're endlessly just talking about what they've done in past game. That's a tone that
I know the past game, but I don't give it that tone. I would be more like, you know, in our last game, I completely ran out of money.
Sure.
So it might be a problem. I'm not saying it's a problem every time, but I'm just letting you know that, you know, I did these mistakes last time and I ran out of money and I'm going to make sure I don't do it this time.
Yeah. But the whole issue of whether to give strategy advice, how much and in what way, actually highlights one of the key tensions and of the job of rules explainer. And I think actually this is one of those areas that redounds very, very much to the benefit of the hobby. It's one of those tensions that really shows the hobby to its in its best light. Because if you think about it, it's kind of a perverse self-defeating role. In the context of a competitive game, the rules explainer is a competitor and trying to equip their competition with the tools with which to defeat them, right? And I think 99.9 repeating percent of rules explainers do this in good faith to the best of their ability. I'm sure there are some people who possibly unintentionally or possibly because they're the hugest jerks on the planet are actually like, I might just underemphasize this bit so I can school these noobs. Whatever, set them aside. I don't think they're representative of much of anything other than possibly sociopathy or narcissism. But it is really strange when you think about how much effort we engage in a nominally competitive activity. Again, we don't view it as competitive. Of people genuinely trying to enable their competition. It's quite neat. And you don't see it in a whole heck of a lot of other competitive endeavors.
Agreed. Another way to bring people back in, because sometimes when you get through a kind of a long explanation or there's a lot of facts being being thrown around is to give them jobs as you're explaining the rules. Okay, now we're going to talk about these personality cards. You know, Jim, that's going to be your job. When someone takes a card from there and their turn's done, you're going to flip over a new card. That's your job. And that sort of brings them back in, and they now are paying attention because now they've got a job to do, and so they'll learn that bit a little bit more than they would have if you didn't.
Yeah, and maybe they'll put away the damn phone.
You'd think that.
Jim does have those two hands, though.
That's true.
One for personality cards, one for the phone.
The other thing I like doing is moving the pieces around on the board. So they get exactly...
Well, Sorry. I immediately saw you as like a five-year-old being like, I like to move the pieces.
Whee! Car goes vroom. No. Like, you just sort of, you know, play out how it's going to work. So it's like, and then we're going to play, you know, we're going to manipulate these pieces, or we're going to claim these cards with these tokens, and you show them where the tokens are going to come from. It's like, oh, those tokens, right? And they see exactly where they're going to come from and how they're going to need to get them.
I should do that more often. The problem is, and this is the same reason why I tend to err towards the side of not giving much strategy advice. I do not want to give anyone an overly determined sense of how anything might happen to work. This was actually, for what it's worth, this was actually a problem when I was teaching ethics. I'm very bad at coming up with examples, with hypotheticals, with scenarios that articulate my point, or a for instance. And so in the context of a game, in the context of an auction game, for example, it's like, well, and the bid might look like this. I don't know if that's a smart bid. I don't want to tell them that that's what a bid looks like. It might or may not be what a bid should look like. Even in a game with which I'm very familiar, like, I know how I play Raw. I don't want to tell other people how they should play Raw, how much risk they should be willing to shoulder. And so I get very seized up and nervous by those possibilities, and I tend, therefore, to underdetermine and give too few examples. But I should definitely do more, because you're right. Just seeing the things in motion is very helpful, and as you pointed out at the outset, will be helpful for people who process information differently. I'll just repeat something that I've said a number of times before. My basic pattern is as follows. And for what it's worth, some people are at a loss about a basic... And I find having a kind of a standard basic pattern is very, very helpful in terms of just organizing your thoughts.
Yeah, especially if you're the one person that always explains the rules all the time.
Yes.
Having the same cadence and the same way you present games is very helpful.
That is absolutely true.
Because they understand, they won't interrupt you as much with questions because they know you're
that has
about
not
to...
been That has not been my experience.
Hey!
Did you see what I was doing there? Did you see?
So they know very well that you're going to cover this next, because it's like, you don't say, okay, well, what about this? And some people might just say, well, what about this, to watch, you know, the vein in your head sort of like pop out a bit.
Oh,
but some other people.
Yeah. No, it's just because if you need to be processing, if you're a regular hobbyist, you're going to be processing lots of different systems. And I find that having a certain framework for presenting those systems means that every time you have to learn a new game to teach, you're not like, well, where do I start? Well, if you have a basic pattern, my basic pattern has always been the same. And for what it's worth, it appears to be relatively successful for a lot of different designs. You start with the victory conditions. Like, the goal of the game is to score points. You score points by forming sets, or various cards will score you points. You then just go over a round structure, and you just detail everything that a player, and keep it player focused. Keep focused on the actions that they do and how they do them, and with a reference towards introducing components only as they come in under player agency. Like, for a long time, actually, one of the key people that I had explained games to me, who was a big fan of Fantasy Flight, explained games the same way that Fantasy Flight games at the time did in the rule books. Like, here are all the components. And a lot of rule books still do this. And that's how he would explain game rules. And it never made sense to me. It's like, all right, I'm now going to spend 5 to 10 minutes at the start of the rules explanation talking over all the various components. It's like, if it's not tied to something I do with them, I'm not going to be able to understand what it's like. These are army counters. Army counters, this is the strength of an army counter. It's like, how do I get them? What do I do with them? When do they show up? What? I would much rather be like, all right, on your turn, you could move. When you move armies. These are army counters. That's the way to do it. That's the way I think it's best to do it. And that's the way that it makes most sense to me. Again, your mileage may vary. And then after I go through all that, I once again circle back. It's a standard rhetorical format. Tell them what you're going to say it, and then tell them what you've said. And for me, it's victory conditions, what you do, victory conditions. That's, by and large, the thrust of either a competitive or a cooperative game. And again, even a relatively suboptimal structure is better than no structure at all. Pointillistic random association rules explanations are the ones that I find the least helpful.
All right. And I know it can be frustrating. I know as a rule explainer, you spend a lot of time reading the rule book. You set the game up in front of yourself. You played through turns. You've gone over like a cadence and or a script because you enjoy this game. You want people to play it. But remember, you're there to have fun and they are there to have fun. Don't get angry. Don't get upset. They are legitimately, most of the time, 99% of the time, they want to learn the game. They are trying to process the information. They're processing it in the way that they process it. Like we said last time, you're setting a social stage. Everyone is there to have fun, and you just need to make sure they're comfortable with the rules, because that will make it more fun for them.
When you were saying don't get angry, don't get frustrated, I understand why you were making eye contact because I'm sitting across from you. Why were you pointing like that?
Sorry. It's just a habit I have. It's nothing to do with you personally, Mark.
Okay, sure. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very, very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our contact information and other sundry useful bits of information at sowronggames.com. We read everything you send us and we'll get back to you if we can. Take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby time, and we hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Biggin. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.